But Ziggy was the one that was he was the primary producer on set. And language is such a big part of our film.
Yep.
And not just patois, but Bob's specific patois. Bob spoke mm-hmm. a very certain way. So having Ziggy there was so helpful in that process, because in order to facilitate changes, we needed that intermediary person there to help.
Hello, and welcome back to The Director's Cut, brought to you by the Directors Guild of America. In this episode, a talented reggae artist overcomes adversity and becomes a worldwide music icon in director Reynaldo Marcus Green's biographical drama, Bob Marley, One Love. The film follows the inspirational true story of Bob Marley, the legendary Jamaican reggae singer-songwriter and guitarist, and chronicles his journey as he becomes a pioneer and master of his craft. In addition to Bob Marley, One Love, Green's other directorial credits include the feature films King Richard, Joe Bell, Monsters and Men, and the TV miniseries We Own This City. Following a screening of the film at the DGA Theater in Los Angeles, Green spoke with director Jeffrey W. Byrd about filming Bob Marley, One Love. Listen on for their spoiler-filled conversation.
What's up, what's up? What's up, folks? Welcome to Black History Month. Here we go. One Love, Bob Marley. Ronaldo, listen, let me tell you something right now. I'm gonna tell you something right now in front of all these people. They didn't give you a standing ovation, but I will, because that was dope.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Listen, if Lashana Lynch does not get an Oscar nomination for this, then something is wrong in America, because her two scenes were standouts. It was amazing. But welcome to the DGA. Welcome to the African American Steering Committee Hour. Jeff Byrd, I'm the co-chair of the African American Steering Committee as well. But I am so glad I was able to, that you allowed me to cue your A here. And this means the world to me. Hopefully it's not just because of the dreadlocks. It's just because we bond in that way. So let's talk about the film real quick. Let's first talk about Mr. Kingsley. Let's talk about the casting of him as Bob Marley, the great Bob Marley. How did you come about that? Like, whose idea was that? You know, was it yours from the beginning? Was there any kind of studio influence or the casting? Give us the full scope of that.
Yeah, so I was in the edit of King Richard at the time that I had first received the first draft of the script. And that's when the journey started for me. And then when I came on as a writer to help kind of bolster that first draft. And it took me about a year. But that's when the casting process started for me. And I knew there was no movie essentially without Bob. So I thought, well, I guess I'll just get this rewrite, get this fee, be fine. Yeah. I secretly probably just didn't think it was possible to find Bob, you know. And we looked at tapes and everything was really far, far, far. We were in like the 11th hour, truthfully, really, really truthfully. And the rights were almost up, and I just didn't think it was going to be possible. And then in my inbox was this tape from Kingsley. And
oh, he submitted a tape himself.
He submitted a tape. And there were several actors that, you know, that are well known that said they were going to submit tapes and then they never came in. Oh, you're going to get a tape from this guy. Would never come. Either they were too scared or it just wasn't right. And so just a lot of folks didn't submit. And we looked everywhere. We looked Jamaica, all over the world, obviously. And I looked at Marley's. I looked at everybody that I possibly could find. And Kingsley's tape showed up. And you know, he has short hair. But there was something. I was just leaning in. All of a sudden, I'm like, okay, I'm shifting in my seat. I'm starting to do what you do when you watch a movie. You know, I'm like, okay. And his tape was really interesting. He had like a three-quarter profile. It's very confident. Even where he placed the tape, I thought was interesting. He didn't send me three different sizes and, you know, close-ups and all, you know, three different styles of tapes. It, you know, just really was interesting. And he made a real interpretation of Bob. It wasn't a mimic. It wasn't something he found on YouTube. And he just, it was, you know, he had me leaning in. Yeah. And so at that point, I remember calling the studio, telling them to watch it, calling Ziggy, say, you know, have you seen the tapes yet? And I think, and then it just was, that was really the moment that I thought, okay, it was possible that the film could happen. And I thought, okay, he did, you know, with prosthetics and maybe some, you know, and with hair, you know, we can figure it out. But he's a big dude. Like Kingsley's like 6'2" and like 225.
Oh, really? I didn't know he was that big.
Yeah, you couldn't. He was smart about the 3/4 profile. Mm-hmm. You couldn't see all of that. Mm-hmm. And then when I saw him in person, I was like, okay. all right, we're gonna figure this out. Mm-hmm. It's movie magic. But yeah, I think, you know, he just had enough of the attributes. He had the look. He's obviously very handsome, but he's super intelligent. You can tell somebody was thinking, and it was in the silence that I saw it. It was in his moments of pause that I was like, okay, this guy's got it, and we're going to go on this journey together. And he had a lot of work to do at that point.
I mean, he did an amazing job. I mean, it reminded me of Denzel in X. And I worked on that film back in the day, you know, 40 Acres of Mule, Stand Up, What's Up, BK to the Fullest. And I worked on that. I was like a PA on that and an intern on that. And like watching Denzel become Malcolm X, I kind of felt that from watching, you know, Kingsley do that here. And props to the hair department, because dreadlock wigs are hard to do. And I'm very hard on dreadlock wigs. And dreadlock wigs are hard to do. And you guys did an amazing, Who was that who did the hair?
So Carla Farmer, who also did King Richard for me, came on to do the hair with a young woman named Nadia Stacey in the UK. In the UK, the hair and makeup department is one person. Mm. And I was like, nah. It's too big of a job. Yeah. It's too big of a job, and we have too much. And essentially, we need one person for Kingsley. And actually, when we did the chemistry test, they had an interim wig, and I almost walked out.
An interim wig. Yeah, it was like that sounds scary, right?
It was scary. It was like one of the ones you could, you know, it looked like one of the ones you could buy online.
Oof.
And we put King, and I was like, okay, this isn't going to work. Like, we have to really figure this out, because, and they had spent a lot of money on him. It wasn't cheap.
Absolutely.
That interim wig wasn't cheap. So the real wig cost a lot of money, and maintaining it cost a lot of money too.
But I'm sure that you guys had a few of those as well, the main wig, and then they only had the one?
We had one.
Wow. So you guys had to put like an armed guard on
it
one
wig. It was like an armed guard, went into the vacuum seal at night. No, but it literally was like, that, you know, the Vanguard trucks, like, where's the wig? Has to come off. Took forever to put on. Mm-hmm. It was a process, but
you could tell it's worth it, because, you know, and also it's good that you were there to maintain that quality control. Because I've seen some films that shall remain nameless with really bad dreadlock wigs, and you could tell that the director didn't really care. It's like, well, it's just a wig, but you know, it's all right. It's the drama of it all. Like, no, that's a terrible wig. So, you know, I'm glad you were there to be the quality control of that. So then let's talk about Lashana Lynch coming on board and, you know, matching the Rita to his Bob. How did that all come about?
So Lashana, I knew a little bit more. I'd seen the Bond film and I'd seen her in some stuff, and I thought she was great. And I met with her here in a cafe in LA, actually. And just, she just had like, just a fierceness to her. Just the way she spoke about being Jamaican and how proud she was, how much Rita meant to her. And I had just met with Rita. I'd flown down to the real Rita. I flew down to Miami to meet her. Just to sit, honestly, just to kiss the ring.
Yep. Got to do that.
I just wanted to be in her presence and feel what that was like sitting with her. And so when I met Lashana, there was just something that felt right. You know, she's just a powerhouse actress. Mm-hmm. And she was like, kind of putting me on, like, how are you going to do this movie? Like, you know, a little bit like that. So I was like, oh, I like that. I like the bite. You know, I'm into that. I think there's something very, real about it, mm-hmm. you know? And so I just liked how kind of forceful she was about getting the role and how we were going to do it. And if she was going to do it, how it was going to be like this. And I was like,
so she was interviewing you a little bit.
Yeah, it was both, man. And it was cool. It was cool. And I love that. I think there's this, it holds you accountable.
Yep.
You know, her script, you know, her truthfully in the early drafts, like Rita was was almost non-existent.
Really?
And so it definitely forced us to go back in and really analyze what that was all about. And part of that happened in my meeting with Rita and meeting with Lashana so that I could figure out how to flesh that out in the script.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't realize that. That's incredible. So, okay, so with that said, now you have those two and fleshed out the rest of the cast, but that now, obviously, you have such a cinematic approach to this film. And, you know, I said this to you back there, and, you know, I'll be, you know, transparent out here. I mean, it looks light years different than King Richard in its cinematic approach and your use of wide angle lenses and seeing all the stuff. And then there's effects of the field burning and then behind the, I mean, talk a little bit about your relationship with your DP, Robert Elswit, and, you know, how you both put your heads together to create such incredible visuals.
Yeah, well, look, Robert is one of the best to ever do it. So, you know, he just truly is. He's remarkable. I met him at the Sundance Lab at 2017 with my first film. Oh, wow. And he was an advisor at the lab. He wasn't even my advisor, but I was like, Robert Elswit over there. Yeah. I had to like strategize how to like get to his table. And I just was like, man, maybe one day I'll like have a movie that I can get to him. Mm. And that fast forward, King Richard happened. And we got to work together. And we just had an amazing time. We just hit it off. We have a very naturalistic style. That's our, and we just talk movies. Very rarely talk lenses or anything like that.
It's really?
Just, we talk movies, we talk story, script. But it comes with just spending a lot of time at his house, you know, just being in his presence. And we just love each other like brothers. So it's kind of a, you know, odd couple relationship, but it's a great one. So yeah, anyway, with this film, because we were coming off of that movie together, I had asked him pretty early on, like, would he do it? He just said, if you could wait a little bit. And so I said, oh, don't worry, I got plenty of script stuff to do, so we can wait. And we found the window that he could shoot it. And yeah, it's just how we location scout. We spent a lot of time going to locations, maybe 7, 8, 9 times before ever shooting in a location. I had never done that before, working with Robert. I go to location once, maybe twice, be ready to shoot. Yeah, no. He needs to see it
again
in the morning when the light, afternoon the light, evening the light. I'm like, what I don't know what he's seeing. He's seeing something. You know, we always go with the script and he's always kind of like, could you stand over there? And, you know, and then he'll go again right just after the light. I'm like, but you couldn't just wait the whole time. Like, we couldn't have just spent the whole day there the one time, you know, but it's great. Like, he needs to see it on different days and different times and different energy. And it's so great because, you know, I think it's taught me a lot about being immersed in a space and how that space becomes so natural. We don't often use marks with our actors. So, and I think it's because we've been to the, you know, I've acted it out 20 times before I got there. And I never say sit there, you know, I'm never like, you know, I will suggest or take a chair out. you don't want actors to sit, so just take chairs. You don't have to sit a lot. You know, the first thing they do, they just go right down. I don't know what it is. So take chairs out.
That's amazing, though, because I have like, you know, arguments and debates with friends of mine in regards to the whole blocking of things and creating iconic shots. Yeah. And you have quite a few of them here. Yeah. So they know that you kind of guided them in the way you wanted them to go.
It's all about the light.
Yep.
And, you know, look, we had to build a lot in this film and you never want to feel like you're on a stage or you never want to feel like you're on a set. So I think Robert, that's what he does so well, is try to make those environments feel natural.
That's mission accomplished, because I never felt like I was on a set. I never did watching the whole film. I never felt you. Yeah.
Great.
Done. So, great. Sold.
It's a lot of sets.
Really?
Yeah, mostly sets. Yeah.
That's incredible. Like bedroom, all that.
Bedroom is a build. Yep.
Really? Okay, so
Hope Road is a build, the whole thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Impressive. But Jamaica was shot for Jamaica, right?
Jamaica was shot for Jamaica, but Hope Road itself was our hero location that we built. So if you've ever been to Jamaica, there's actually the Bob Marley Museum, which is 56 Hope Road, which our build was closer to the real architecture. Mm-hmm. It's changed over time. So our replica was actually closer to the real thing.
And then London, UK for UK, right?
So UK for UK.
And Paris for Paris?
No. No other countries.
No other countries.
Yeah, we were not allowed to travel on our budget. So.
Okay. So yeah. Paris was faked.
Yes.
A little bit. Okay. No Belgium, Paris. All that stuff was fake. And okay, well, you had me the whole time. So musically, sonically, so first of all, also you had the rights. You had the family approved scenario there, which I think is amazing. That's a, if I had my hat on, I would take it off. That's a hats off scenario right there that you had the whole family to approve. And you had Ziggy, from what I'm hearing, you had what you just said, yeah. You had Ziggy on the set most of the time.
Yeah, every day.
Every day Ziggy was there.
Every day.
That's incredible. And to have gotten all the things you got from, you know, Bob and, you know, Rita and the music and everything, and having Ziggy on a set every day is amazing. Because usually, you know, I did this film for Showtime where it's real people. And I was like, oh, you can't do that. No, you can't. Don't make him look like this and don't make him look like that. And so, but I love the fact that you were able to delve into that. And even with the little, you know, ladies on the side and stuff like that, the subtle look to that was really good. And I thought you gave us the idea of he had a larger life than what we even saw.
Yeah, I have a family, so I know what that's like. They're very protective, and they mm-hmm. should be. You know, like if my dad, if I was making a movie about my dad or my mom, she'd be like, "Don't put me in that shirt." Mm-hmm. It'd always be some clothing thing. You know, mm-hmm. like, don't put me in that. Or why do you make me look like that? It's always mm-hmm. it's usually the small things, mm-hmm. not the big things. It's always the small things. And I was so blessed on King Richard to have Esha Price, who's the sister mm-hmm. of Venus and Serena, on set. And just the character nuance, characterization, the specificity is what helped those performances. And there was no different here. I think there's just more Marleys. That mm-hmm. there was just a lot more. But Ziggy was the one that was he was the primary producer on set. And language is such a big part of our film.
Yep.
And not just patois, but Bob's specific patois. Bob spoke mm-hmm. a very certain way. So having Ziggy there was so helpful in that process because I'm not a native patois speaker. Kingsley's not a native patois speaker. So in order to facilitate changes, we needed that intermediary kind of person there to help. And I always speak in movie terms. I don't talk, you know, it's always about the movie, you know, and I think that's the way to communicate with family members. At least I've been fortunate is to take it out of the personal. We're making a movie. Everything we're doing is fake. The whole thing is fake. The moment you step on a film set, it is fake. We're recreating our version of a truth. And that's all we're doing. And we have to just speak in those terms so that they can understand, you know, that, oh, okay. Like I understand that the bullet happened here, but we can't see it on camera.
Exactly.
You know, those kind of things, little things that just say, okay, it happened outside, but we can move it inside, or, you know, just to help them through the process of making a movie. And I think they respect that if you can be open. That doesn't mean you're not going to get into it at times, but it's usually positive.
I mean, and you did all that well too. It's funny, we were talking outside about the patois of it all, and people, you know, people who are like true Jamaicans are like, well, you know, the patois, this and patois, I don't know, it needs to be deeper than that. And I don't know if people really understand, and we were talking about this, if it was true patois, you'd have to put subtitles up there. No one would be able to understand it except for true hardcore Jamaicans. But coming from Brooklyn, like I come from, this is closer to the New York, this is closer to the New York patois, which you're from New York as well. So, and I think, I mean, discuss the process of, you know, Kingsley and, I mean, I know LaShawn already had that, but getting Kingsley there, was it like, yeah, like dialect coach or anything?
Yeah, so it was a pretty arduous process to get Kingsley because he, you know, he can't read it in the same way. He needs to read it phonetically. So mm-hmm. in order to translate it, we needed a translator to translate it into patois, and then it needed to be broken down phonetically for him to read it. But he has to also understand what he's reading. Mm-hmm. So that process, it's hard to improvise when you're doing it that way. So if you have an improvisational style like I do, that can be very challenging at times to move quickly. You know, you're not a speedboat, you're a Titanic. You have to have this person read it, and then it has to be transcribed, and then he has to understand it. So that process could be really, really challenging. So we tried to get ahead of as many script changes as you can. But as you know, things change. Performances change. the moment changes and you have to go with that. And so we just had to deal. That's just, that's what it was for this. But I think the biggest thing was surrounding Kingsley in real situations. Mm-hmm. So we cast real Jamaicans. I mean, and we cast real family members. So, you know, family man Barrett's son is playing him in the film. You have Aston Barrett Jr. playing his father, you know, so he's not only a musician, but it's real patchwork. So it's specific to his father. You have Junior Marvin's son playing his son in the film. And so just add that layer of authenticity. All the musicians are musicians in the film, except for Kingsley. So Lashana sings. She was a singer before she was an actress.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So she can sing. Naomi Cowan, Anna, all the I3 singers. All the musicians were musicians. And so Kingsley was put into a real situation. So when I call cut, they were still jamming out. You know, it was literally jamming. It was fun. It was like, those are the most fun scenes, because they were just in it. You know, if I go to grab a guitar, I look so silly because I don't know how to grab it. I don't know how to play it. But a real musician knows how to grab the guitar. So the nuances of that you feel in the performance because they're real. Mm. And Kingsley's a savant. Like, he can teach himself pretty much anything. Like, I heard him at a press tour the other day. It was like French. And I was like, you speak French? He was like, no, I just needed to say some stuff. Mm. It's like, oh, okay. I guess that's how it works. You know, he's that gifted, but he worked tirelessly. He listened to, you know, countless hours of Bob tapes for months and months. He taught himself how to play guitar.
Oh, wow.
You know, he had a vocal coach, he had a dialect coach. There were a lot of people supporting that performance, and yeah, just his commitment to the craft to try to get it right.
Wow.
Okay. For DJ folks in the audience, I want to talk a little bit about your team, your support team, the AD team, and knowing full well, I've shot music videos in Jamaica, and a couple of friends of mine in the audience have also shot in Jamaica. So knowing how hard it is sometimes to shoot in Jamaica, you know, how are you able to, first your AD team, your first AD, second AD, dealing with that, like, and also wrangling all those extras there. Like, how did you put all that together, especially for the Jamaica part?
Well, it was my second time shooting in Jamaica. So that was a bit of a homecoming for me. I did a show called Top Boy a couple of years ago. So it was great to go back.
Shouts out, Top Boy. Love that.
Top Boy fans. Look, the crews in Jamaica are great. I think the infrastructure is a little, you know, that's the part where it's a bit tricky. There's no tax credit. And so everything has to be flown in. And we were just a movie of a certain scale. Probably one of the larger films to shoot there since Bond. So we had to shoot at a certain time. But it was really great. I think we were obviously shooting in really rough areas. We were shooting in Trenchtown, and we had security things that we had to worry about. Anyway, shooting in Jamaica was fantastic. It's no different than anywhere else, man. We had tremendous support from the people in Jamaica to make this movie. We couldn't have made it without them.
In fact, it was
Natalie Thompson, our producer. If you ever shoot in Jamaica, she is the go-to producer there.
Natalie is the one.
Yeah. I mean, look, we were rolling with a lot of people. So, you know.
Now, did you use the same AD team in Jamaica and everywhere?
We did.
So the same AD team in Jamaica, the UK.
So we were based out of London. That was our home base. Okay. We shot London first, and then we went to Jamaica at the end to shoot all its Jamaica parts.
How many weeks in Jamaica? How many weeks in London? How many weeks in Jamaica? If you can remember.
I'd say we started 2 weeks before Christmas, December of last year, in London, and then we finished in February, and then we had a month hiatus to get everything over to Jamaica. And we shot March and finished in April, so 2 months, 26 days, I believe, we shot total in Jamaica.
In Jamaica, beautiful, nice. That was good. And so with that said, in regards to like your crowd, like the vis effects of it all, let's talk about that a little bit in regards to how you were able to get that humongous crowd scene at the big concert and the full 360 around, which I thought was super, super duper cinematic. And also the flames behind the crowd and from the first concert where he saw his shooter, you know, envisioned his shooter out there waiting for him.
Yeah, well, the first, the Exodus tour actually happened
primarily because of a budgetary constraint. I thought I was going to be going to all these places. It's like, great, I get to make a big movie. I get to go to Denmark, Paris. No, that's not how it works, I guess. So like, get creative. So I was like, all right, well, how do I do that? So yeah, I thought about a transitional way for us to get through all these cities. And we had to do costume changes, but we essentially shot in a black box like this on a stage. I missed that.
Somebody said it was what? Brilliant.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so
brilliant.
Much.
We got a rowdy crowd tonight. Welcome. No, welcome. Here we go.
Love it. Let's go.
Black History Month. Here we go. Let's do it. I'm from Brooklyn, so we're going to do it. If we're going to do it, we're going to do it. If you're going to yell it out, then just yell it out real quick and let it go.
Let's go.
So you shot in a black box like this for that 360.
For the 360. And then obviously we had to change our, you know, we changed the crowd several times. We had to change the band several times, and that's how we transition through various, you know, whether it's someone's arm or sleeve, and it goes to black, and then we're in a different venue. And so the idea was that Bob's fame was growing at the time, so the venues get larger and larger as we continue to go around. And so the crowds continue to grow. And that was the conceit. And yeah, we had a great visual effects team. Yep. I would say we had probably an average of 250 to 300 extras on those particular days, and then everything else is blue screen.
Got it. Were you like plating them? Were you moving your?
We did tons of plates, indoor and outdoor, obviously. Had them doing lots of, you know, different dances and all. So a lot of the close up crowd shots, we actually got in additional photography. We had no time in the shooting days to get it because most of it was scene work. And so we had to do, you know, we shot the backstage, the Don Taylor moment where he gets beat up. So a lot of our days really got sucked up in scene work, which is what we focused on and thought, okay, if we're going to drop anything, it'll be crowd. And then hopefully they'll love the movie and let us go back and get it.
And did they?
They did.
There it is. Mission accomplished. So now just going towards, you know, the end, like when you're in during the end of your filmmaking process and you're in editing, how much editorially would you say, how you know, much did you stick to the script and how much did you feel like you changed once you got into the edit room with your editor?
I think the fundamental was there. The timeline was always there. The A story was always there. The flashbacks were the things that took the longest to find.
Love those flashbacks, by the way.
Thank you. There were more than what you see. So we shot a fair amount of stuff that's not in the movie. And it just felt like the movie couldn't bear it.
Director's cut. I'm feeling director's cut is coming somewhere down the line.
Yeah, this is, you know, no, this is as close to the director's cut as this is going to be. And I feel very confident in this cut. I love the stuff they say you have to kill your darlings. That's just the truth. Some of my favorite stuff is on the cutting room floor, but that's another movie. I love this movie and I'm happy with the choices we made.
I love that answer. Look at that. Studio smiling. Everybody smiles. That great answer. So
the extended, what do you call those? The deleted scenes.
Deleted that'll scenes. The DVD, yes. The when it comes. Yes. That's what it'll be on iTunes. Deleted scenes. So with that said, now that it's out and it's number one, I would say, isn't it number one right now? It's number one out there, folks. Number one for the weekend. And it deserves to be. Very much so deserves to be. And I'm super happy for you. Congratulations. And also, you know, it's interesting. We were talking about this outside. Much like myself, like my sister is in the business, is casting director and all. And your brother is also a director as well. So it's kind of like, you know, you both have, you know, it's that family thing. I love that. I mean, you know, tell us how that works out for you and your brother.
Well, it's a long story, but I'm the baby brother.
We got all the time in the world.
Ernesto Green. He's a brilliant filmmaker. And honestly, the reason that I decided to leave my job at AIG to go to film school.
So, what?
I was working in diversity and inclusion for AIG.
There it is, folks. Amazing.
I know. And then, thanks to him for inspiring me to chase a dream, you know, chase a dream at 27. And here we are now.
That's incredible. I love the fact that you both are doing your thing, but both, I mean, I've known Rashad for a long time and now getting to know you, you know, I feel that same energy from you, you know, feel that same New York energy, that New York vibe. So then what's next? And what's next, and what else do you want to do? Because now the world is your oyster, obviously. After, you know, King Richard and this, your consistency is proven. And you make Oscar winners. You create Oscar winners. So, you know, what's next? Where you go? Where you head?
I mean, I'll take my kids to Little League, pick them up, to drop them off at school. Like, that's the most fun time for me, being able to take my sons to.
Do they know that daddy got Will Smith an Oscar? Do they know that?
They're starting to pick up. They don't really know what that means, and I love that. I love that because they don't care, and they just want me to be home, and that's what kids.
Oh, that's
so sweet.
No, it's a great reminder that, like, just love what you do, and you know, we make the sacrifices, but it's all for them, and one day they'll know that. I'm writing again. You know, that was my first passion, you know, to write and try to figure out personal stories. You know, I've directed other people's movies, and that may continue, but until someone calls me and says, you know, this is the next thing that I think everything that I've put my name on, I've really cared about. So I just hope that whatever comes, that we'll feel the same. And so I know that I can care about the things that I'm writing because they're from my own brainchild. So I'll just continue to do that until the phone rings.
And that will be very soon. But yeah, I love that you have, you know, two cards, you know, like I have Writers Guild and DGA, and that's amazing. And that's a beautiful thing to have and be able to write your own stuff. Any interest in the TV side at all? Or is there any?
Yeah, done TV. I've gone from film
from the creation
to TV. So I did Monsters and Men, and then I did Top Boy, and then I did Joe Bell, and then I did King Richard, and then I did We Own the City for HBO. So yeah, I've done TV.
I mean, creating the show. Oh, you're going to creating.
Yeah, creating.
I know your whole resume, but I'm like looking for showrunning.
Another thing. It requires a tremendous amount of time. Yeah, show running's different. I like directing. I love actors. I love actors. I love working with actors. That's the most fun part. Actually, we get to do it the least. You know, it's like when you're a professional athlete, you're actually only playing the game for this much. The rest is the preparation. And then it's, you know, you show up at the field at 12 o'clock for an 8 o'clock game, taking batting practice, pitching, whatever you're doing. And then you actually only get to play for an hour and a half, you know? So, you know, I love being on the field. There's just something that communal process of working with people and that energy, there's nothing like it. And so, yeah, I'm eager to get back on the field for the right thing.
And you said that at the right place, the Directors Guild. You said that at the right place because we all love to get back on the field. I want to thank you so much for sharing this film with us.
Thank you.
And having me do the Q&A.
Thank you.
You are the man. You are the myth. You are the legend, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Thanks for listening to another DGA Q&A. The Director's Cut is available wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share, subscribe, rate, and review. We'd love to hear your feedback, and you can help fellow film buffs find the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is produced by the Directors Guild of America.